Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Dan Johnson, conservative Charlie Kirk, libertarian David Masciola, and Chris Voronis, our card-carrying Republican. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in downtown Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to tweet us a question, it's at BTB Dumont. Lots of things to cover this evening. We have a new voice joining our panel this evening. David, let me say welcome to you. This is Masciola. I think I blew it in the opening, but nice to have you with us. He is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, and you'll hear more about him as the program unfolds. But I want to begin, obviously, with still one of the big stories in the world, and that is Russia. Based on what has happened in the last week, based on the president's triumphant tour of Europe and Saudi Arabia, I want to get reaction from you, Charlie Kirk, as to whether or not the president was able to demonstrate any great salesmanship when he met with the leaders of Europe. Are they going to get tougher on the Russians?
Yeah, I don't think it ever should have been a thing about salesmanship. I think he's mishandled it from the beginning. I mean, I think this echoes a lot of things similar. And of course, you know, when people bring up this example, it evokes certain emotion. It's similar to what happened with the Sudetenland. You know, it's reclaiming what we think is ours back to Putin. And it's just he's going to keep on pushing until people push back. And he doesn't have sovereignty over this country. Ukraine has its own rights, yet he's just marching in on his own. What he thinks is correct, and it's up to the international community and Europe to push back, and there are many economic implications. Yeah.
David, are we a paper tiger as a nation now? And is this a good example of why we are a paper tiger?
Well, there's something within the American presidency now that leads to an underestimation of Vladimir Putin and Russia. If you remember, President Bush said that he looked into the eyes of Putin. And because Putin was wearing a crucifix, he could see within his soul that he was a good man. Probably one of the silliest statements made in recent memory by an American president. And President Obama now has egg all over his face because he mocked Mitt Romney when Romney said that Putin was a geopolitical force very seriously.
As right? the media, they kind of raise their eyebrows.
Right, right. So Putin has twice, perhaps, made us look foolish on an international stage, and it's going to be very difficult to regain that credibility.
Chris Voronis, our card-carrying Republican tonight.
There's an uncomfortable reality with how this is all playing out, no matter if you're right, left, middle, black, white, yellow, as the Reverend Jackson would tell us. Vladimir Putin has played this masterfully from the beginning. In fact, that was his game plan. The moment he sent in Soviet troops without the Russian flag on their shoulders,
and put them in masks.
And unfortunately, this kind of name calling that's happening right now belies the fact that right now, unfortunately, the United States is actually negotiating in a position of weakness. Putin has the cards, and the focus is no longer on Crimea. It's on other things.
Dan Johnson is our card-carrying Democrat. Being thrown out of the G8, does that mean a hill of beans to Vladimir Putin?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, I'm having a hard time getting really worked up over this. It seems like...
It's because you're a Democrat. That defines a Democrat.
Right. No, I mean,
you don't
like,
get worked up over people kicking sand in your face.
Right. So that's the idea, right? We like to beat the war drums, and we like to make it this analogy and metaphor. So listen, here's what happened.
That's okay.
So the Crimeans sure seem to prefer Russia to Ukraine. It's crude, but you can't make up all these spontaneous demonstrations. They all speak Russian.
There
right?
was only one choice on the ballot. It was a yes.
So,
that
right? was that one. But, you know, if most people wanted to stick with Ukraine, it'd have a different feel, right? And there is something towards this right of, self-governance. That if it's true, and I suspect it is, that most people in Crimea prefer to be a part of Russia than to be part of Ukraine, then I'm having a hard time getting all excited. And
why are there, in your view, why are there 40 to 50,000 Russian troops on the border now? Putin has said it's an exercise. Why do you think they're there?
I think what they've been saying pretty clearly, and Gorbachev said this too, is that the NATO expansion ever eastward is what they're really concerned about. And they consider that to be a betrayal. And they don't think NATO should expand ever east. And I think they're, beating their chest and saying, you're coming like right up to our doorstep. And they consider the, toppling the democratically elected president of Ukraine, in Putin's words, to be some fascist coup. And clearly we're on the side of the guys that took over that country. So to say now we're so angry because what, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe all the Crimeans actually want to be part of Ukraine, in which case I'd have a problem. But if all
that's
the
be the case.
Yeah, if all the Crimeans want to be part of Russia, what are we so angry about?
But what about all the Russians in Estonia? What about all the Russians in the other parts of the former Soviet bloc? I mean, what happens if they start to say, hey, we want to be part of Russia?
Right,
too,
so I kind of have to push back against that example. Just because a segment of a certain country would want to be part of another country doesn't necessarily justify an international takeover of that specific region. I mean, just because that they might speak that language, it would be there are very many examples where countries are bordering each other. It would be like the North Koreans want to be part of South Korea. Well, if you take a poll of it, that doesn't necessarily justify an invasion or takeover. I mean, this is an international violation of sovereignty that is putting the entire world on hostage just because Putin wants to go back to the same borders.
President, but also, what does it say about NATO, whether NATO means anything either? I mean,
is NATO just a figurehead of countries together, or is it an actual some sort of organization that's supposed
David,
to
be? David, what do you think of that?
President Obama's a victim of his own macho posturing on the issue. He's like the guy who...
Macho posturing. It's hard to put that in the same sentence with Barack Obama. Macho posturing.
Well,
but go ahead.
Well,
I'm going to give an entirely
different issue, but related to America's projection of itself in foreign affairs. He gave Assad in Syria a red line, which he failed to enforce. Mm-hmm. Then he threatened the Ukrainian government when they started cracking down on the protesters, and he failed to enforce that. So he's like the guy who calls his own shot over the left field wall but then hits a grounder to third. But in his defense, now that the situation exists as it does, I don't know what else he could be doing to rectify it. He's levying economic sanctions. He's railing diplomatic pressure. I don't think anyone is advocating, even the most hawkish, that we invade Russia.
No, I don't think there's any.
So what options remain?
There isn't any significant call for.
Right.
So there,
exactly.
There really isn't. So we're going to hope that the 50,000 troops really are an exercise. We will look for his next move, and hopefully we will have figured out his next move prior to his making that move. 1-800-723-8029 is the phone number. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029. We've been talking about the president's trip to Europe and to also went to Saudi Arabia to kiss the ring there. But speaking of kissing the ring, he also went to the Vatican. He met with the Pope, and two of the world's great politicians got together. What does it mean when Barack Obama, who may be having some trouble with his Catholic support, meets with the Pope, and he gets that nice photo op on the front page of every major U.S. newspaper. Is that a big plus?
Yeah, and you know,
Catholics see through that.
And Barack used to, be a Catholic Church employee of a matter of sorts, since this group was funded by a Catholic Church grant. So, he's got some, and he is. I think it's the social justice wing of the Catholic Church is strong.
Which is your favorite wing?
My favorite wing.
Not the pro-life wing.
No.
Right. Yeah. Not as enthusiastic about that
right,
particular wing. No.
Chris, from a political standpoint, how does that play to you?
I think it's brilliant.
I think it's brilliant.
I think Barack Obama knows that his numbers are going down with Latino voters in the United States. I think all Latino voters across the country know deportations have been an all-time high. Oh. And one thing that would go a long, long way to speaking to those voters is being arm in arm with the Pope, a Latin Pope.
30% of the 70 million Catholics in America are Hispanic.
Yeah.
Wow. And there are 9 bishops within the Catholic Church that are going to the Arizona-Mexico border for a visit, for a photo op, and also a visible stance to deal with the issue of immigration, illegal immigration in the country. And there's a real strong feeling for that, and obviously it goes with the Pope's thoughts about, you know, poverty. Charlie?
Right, it's too bad he's not running for president again. Yeah. Also, this would really help him. I mean, nobody better than President Obama to do retail politics to get certain segments of the population to like him again. I mean, you look back in the campaign trail, he'd go to a college campus and promise students everything that they need, free loans, free health care, and he'll do what it takes to get his poll numbers up. It's just, you got to think, well,
is there any politician that won't do that?
Well, no, I mean, he's really good at it, is what
he's
I'm saying.
Good
he's extremely good at it.
And he needs it.
Probably he's better at that than anything else he's ever done in his presidency. He's better at soliciting support through certain segments, politicians, celebrities, than any politician that I've seen, probably since Bill Clinton.
His comments certainly inspired your generation, and you know, 7 years ago, your generation as well, David. Do the people of your generation, how old are you? You're
29.
29, okay. Yeah. Do the people of your generation still, are they somewhat awed by the coolness of Barack Obama? And how in 2016 can the Democratic Party regain sort of the coolness of their candidate when their candidate looks like it's someone from a different decade in more ways than one?
Well, I think they're awed by superficiality. And so Hillary, if you're referring to Hillary Clinton.
Your generation?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay.
Yes. And I don't know if that makes my generation very different from generations that preceded it. It's just they're not very engaged. They're not very aware. So they tend to make decisions on an emotional basis. So the first female president would have an appeal to them that would probably overpower reason, logic, and evidence. So that's, if that's too cynical, I apologize. But I
yeah,
guess
that's,
you sound
yeah,
like a Gen Xer.
Yeah, right.
But we'll take a look at the, is there a more appropriate friendship to develop than the one that might between President Obama and Pope Francis? I think that they both capture this phenomena. We don't see much significant policy change from the Pope, but we see a radical reorientation of rhetoric.
And style.
And yeah. style. And that's exactly how President Obama rose to the White House, rhetoric over policy. So the power of the media and the way that social media enhances the power of traditional media means that I think the bar is lower for convincing and persuading people to support a certain program or politician.
So when we're looking politically ahead, we don't, you know, we'll start by talking about Hillary. And the question that I'm saying is, a candidate from yesterday, Hillary Clinton is a candidate for yesterday. What Barack Obama was able to do and what most presidential elections are about the future.
Yeah.
How does a woman of Hillary's advancing years, how does she become the fresh, hot property for the Democratic Party in 2016 when you may have on the right, in addition to people that are being, you know, we'll talk about Jeb Bush in a minute. But at the moment, one of the hottest properties in the Republican Party is a guy who knows a little bit about social media, a little bit about messaging, a little bit about reaching young people, and that's Rand Paul. I mean, if you look at the dynamics of the country, Rand Paul versus Hillary Clinton, not in a face-to-face, we're not there yet, but just talk about sort of the demographics and the appeal of those two candidates in the on the political landscape.
I think you're right that Hillary Clinton will not be fresh, hip, you know, amazing and cool in the way that Barack was and is.
Don't be so friendly to her.
Right? But she's going to be, if she wants it, she will be the nominee. There's a remarkable consensus among the Democratic Party electorate now that we'd be delighted with her. And I think she'll be...
Let me ask you. I want to press Democrats. Yeah, yeah. Why would you be delighted with her when you represent a party that when you list the people who are perceived to be presidential timber, you get to her, there really isn't a number two. If you call Schweitzer a number two, Joe Biden probably is a number two.
Absolutely.
So you got the two of them.
I'm a Bidenite.
But there's two. There's two.
Yeah.
You go to the Republican Party, there's about five or six that are viable national players that could be the Republican nominee, and if you are the Republican nominee, you can be president.
I'll tell you
what. I want to get everybody's reaction. I'm going to give it to you first.
Thank you.
Then I want to hear Chris.
I'll tell you why. I think because the people that would be the third, the fourth, the fifth, the sixth governors out there are senators. Hillary kind of sucks the oxygen out of the room. So what's the point right now of positioning yourself as a potential nominee when everybody knows if she wants
she sucks
it, it's hers
the super
for
the delegates
taking.
Out of the room, not the oxygen. Yeah. The super delegates she sucks out of the room because her husband.
And she's the establishment candidate. She could draw money, corporate money,
exactly.
And she could play. She's got the same "this is history" play that Obama did.
Right.
And let's face it, when Obama ran in 2008, he wasn't all that impressive. Less than 100 days in the Senate, and you know, as we've heard,
he was impressive
it was a triumph
as a candidate,
of rhetoric.
Though.
Yes, but it was all style, all sizzle and no steak.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people manifested their dreams and beliefs into that campaign. But I say it's about ideas. I really believe that, and it's also about a candidate. The two people that have
it's
really
not about gender though.
No,
you don't think the freshness of having the first woman president is enough to propel her through these
right.
troubled
I think
waters.
It is. I think that there are women Republicans I would nominate that are fantastic. Some governors that are doing great, Susana Martinez, Nikki Haley. I mean, these are women governors that are doing fantastic things. So I wouldn't dismiss the fact that the Republicans wouldn't nominate a woman. But it's about ideas. Ron Paul has gotten the youth more energized than any other politician.
Rand Paul.
Ron and Rand. I said Ron intentionally.
Right.
I mean, Ron, since the 1990s, have gotten the youth behind these ideas of constitutionally limited government, liberty, and he's 78 years old. So it's not always about the aging politicians, about the ideas.
It seems that the
David.
It seems that the moral compass of the country is now in the hands of white liberal women and the media, the same media that I would think even Dan would acknowledge was entirely tilted towards President Obama during the 2012 and 2008 races is going to come out with ballistic firepower for Hillary Clinton. And that alone, along with the history factor, is going to give her a significant advantage, despite all of her flaws, which are immense.
She will be 67 in 2016, but there will be serious energy behind a Hillary Clinton for president.
Oh, there's no question about it.
Yeah, because it, as you were saying before, it is about ideas, and the sizzle and the stake of Barack Obama is that it was a more progressive approach to governing, which has in fact happened. The critique,
that isn't her.
But that's the point. There was a critique of Hillary. The critique was she did vote to authorize that war in Iraq.
Correct.
And had she not, she would have been the nominee. There's no critique in it. That's the way it was. That's how it played. And that
came down to the wire. I mean,
They were fighting. Had she not supported that ridiculous, worst foreign policy mistake in the last 50 years.
Obama did have a better ground game,
right?
So that's the thing.
Then Hillary would have been the nominee. There is no critique of Hillary Clinton right
and
now.
And don't underestimate the magic and power of the word sexism. Mm-hmm. Whenever someone attempts to criticize Hillary Clinton, especially he, is going to have to walk very lightly on thin ice because the sexism charge is hanging overhead.
Do you have any evidence?
And the media will play that up big time.
Oh yeah. Name like one high profile scenario where she's been critiqued and she played the sexist card. Because I don't buy
not
it.
Not she, but her protectors, like the Lawrence O'Donnells and Rachel
Maddow.
I mean, anytime anybody says anything about Hillary Clinton with Benghazi, they say it's just because it was a woman as Secretary
right.
of State. Well, no, it's because four Americans died. And I'll put Lawrence O'Donnell clip after Rachel Maddow clip. Those are her protectors. She puts those people out there like attack dogs, and they'll say it, and we have to back off, or else we're called sexist or misogynist.
Right.
I
wouldn't hesitate to say that she will play the card because there's always been a very unbecoming self-pity factor in her public remarks and public persona. Unlike Thatcher, this is a woman who has not driven a car in 25 years.
You want to talk about out of touch? People say Republicans are out of touch. Hillary Clinton has not driven a car in 25 years. I mean, they say Republicans are out of touch. That should be talked about. I mean, this is a woman who's been driven around for the last 25 years.
She took heavy fire in Bosnia.
So,
oh, yeah, she took heavy fire. And I'm telling you, the Benghazi thing.
So we shouldn't talk about woman drivers.
No, I'm just...
This is not a joke about... I mean, this is not one of those sexist things about women drivers.
See, this is exactly what's going to happen.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Hop on the line tonight live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us on the eve of the opening of the 2014 baseball season. I'm going to be at Comiskey Park, or I always call it Comiskey Park, the Cell. Tomorrow, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the White Sox take on the Twins. It's one of those days. Keith Olbermann, who was on with George Stephanopoulos today, talking about that there's something magic in the air when it's baseball season. Is everybody at the table a baseball fan?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I'll be at the game
tomorrow. Does everybody agree with that there is, I mean, partisanship aside, it's where you see all stripes getting together for the...
It's magic for Keith Olbermann because he has a job.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
no, opening day's awesome.
But I think it's magic.
If he makes stuff up, he'll still have a job.
I think it's like there is something special. There's something, because you don't, you know, the White Sox don't look very good on paper, and maybe they won't be very good on the field. But there's this, even if you're Cub fans. And
absolutely.
You're a season ticket holder of the Cubs now.
I am.
A wealthy man, a Democrat.
Along with eight other people, I'm a season ticket holder for one. But, yeah, opening day is awesome. It's one of the best times of the year.
It is. We are now going to introduce, or we're going to let each of our guests introduce themselves. And we're going to start this evening with our newest panel member who has not been on the program before. And it is David Masiotra.
Yes, you got it.
Tell us about yourself.
Yes, David Masiotra. Well, I'm a longtime listener and viewer of the program. I'm a big fan, so I hope that you can elevate me on your coattails tonight, Bruce.
Okay.
I'm a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, a regular contributor to the Daily Beast, which is Newsweek's website. I also write for The Federalist and Splice Today. And in the fall, I have a book coming out called All That We Learned About Living, the Art and Legacy of John Mellencamp.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I believe in rock and roll much more than I believe in any political platform. So.
And you described yourself, once upon a time you were a liberal, but now you think you're switching over and much more of a libertarian.
Yes.
What caused the switch? So. Are there issues that cause the switch?
Yeah, there's practical and moral arguments involved. Practically, I started to encounter more experience in the free market, and I began to realize very simple truths, like if I want to buy a house, which I did recently, I can buy something bigger, better, in a safer neighborhood if property taxes are lower, and I decided to move to Indiana instead of Illinois for that very reason. Hundreds of thousands of people have made that same decision. That's trivial compared to the fact that, according to Columbia University and MIT, the world's worst poverty, meaning people living on a dollar or less a day since 1970, has declined by 80%. And all economists attribute that to globalization. Free trade, more opportunities for commerce across Africa and China and other parts of Asia. And then also I came to recognize the great truth. I'm still very socially liberal, but I came to recognize the great truth in the words of one of America's best writers, Henry David Thoreau, who wrote in On Civil Disobedience, which inspired Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. That which governs least governs best. I want the government and their shallow, slow-witted hacks out of my life. I don't want these people involved in my affairs. I want to be free to make a phone call without the paranoia of thinking that they're listening. I want to be free to start a business without the punishment of their regulations. And I want to be free to buy a house without having to worry about a large property tax burden.
Charlie Kirk, the first time you were on the show, which was about a couple of months ago, when we gave you sort of a grand welcome as well, mm-hmm. you probably agree with about 99% of what David just had to say. And 100%. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, because you have a more conservative perspective and you identify yourself as a conservative, but not as a Republican.
Correct. What a wonderful statement. That was fantastic. I'm Charlie Kirk. I'm the founder of Turning Point USA, a national student movement I founded right out of high school. I'm not a Republican. I stand on principle, free market ideas, limited government. I don't think the government should spend more money than it takes in.
Is there any Democrat you like?
I respect Cory Booker. You know why? Because he had dinner with Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Mike Lee, and he has a goal to sit down with every single Republican in the Senate before June. I haven't heard a Democrat say that in like my lifetime. I don't agree with Cory Booker on a lot of stuff. I like him. I want more people to get along with. He's a
media darling.
Cory Booker said he had a four-hour dinner with Ted Cruz, and they didn't even talk about policy. It was about constitutional stuff. That's a great thing to say, but I like Cory Booker. But what I will say is, it's a blessing to be able to be here and all this, to speak politics. But I believe in ideas over party, and I actually have a column coming out this week on the forgotten generation, which I believe is the millennials, on how our generation is being forced to pay for the price of free stuff and big government. And I think that the more that we engage the younger generation, the better.
So. Dan Johnson also joins us. Once upon a time, a member of the younger generation, still a young man.
Holding on.
But you were first on this program when you were about Charlie's age. You've been on the show for over 18 years.
It's been a long time. Yeah, I first came on when I was representing the Ralph Nader campaign, when I was his campaign manager in Illinois.
Before you switched.
Before I joined the Democratic Party, the pragmatic governing coalition that brings a greater standard of living to the country and, indeed, the world. As a homeowner myself that choose to do it in Illinois, I like buying things like a safe neighborhood. I like buying things like public schools, which are cheaper for me to do than to buy private schools. And I like being able to buy things like when I turn on my water, I can drink it because of those, pesky regulations to stop companies from dumping toxic chemicals. I'd like more regulations on companies like BP that just dump some more oil into Lake Michigan that I'm going to drink, and I wish we would regulate those companies more so that I wouldn't get sick, which is one of the reasons why I have become aware, with a little bit more seasoning than my friends to the left of me, not politically, but literally to the left of me, that more people are better off with the right mix of regulations and taxes to buy things cheaper than you otherwise can.
And stepping up to the soapbox and making his introduction is Chris Voronis, our card-carrying Republican.
I am Chris Voronis. I run a communications consulting firm in town. And I got to tell you, I mean, Dan and myself, we're almost 40. And compared to our friends Charlie and David, we're the old folks here.
Yes,
but
you
I got to tell you, it warms.
What does that make me?
It warms the cockles of my heart to hear what's driving these guys. And there's a lot more people out there, and in many ways, and I'm not a libertarian, and I philosophically I'm a conservative, and everything that goes with that. But the thing that brings libertarians and conservatives together is the idea of limited government, individual responsibility. So that is a growing undercurrent in the electorate today. One guy, Rand Paul, I don't agree with him all the time, really speaks to that. And it's going to be a force
He's
to be reckoned with.
He's the hot guy.
Conservatarian. Right. In the same way that undercurrent grew in the late 70s with Ronald Reagan.
Can I just ask,
yes.
did Chris use the word cockles? I thought he did. Just checking. Okay. That's all I asked.
I want to get back to the future of the Republican Party, but I want to talk to you, Charlie, because you were at the CPAC convention.
Yes, I was.
And Turning Point USA, you had one of the hot groups there. You had a lot of activity going on there. What signal does that success of Rand Paul at that convention send to the rest of the party? And is that one of the reasons, in addition to his own, I think, adept political activities, does it just send absolute shockwaves through the heart of the Republican establishment? And that's why they are desperately trying to convince Jeb Bush to get into this race because they don't think that Chris Christie can make it all the way anymore?
Yes and no. The winner of the CPAC straw poll traditionally doesn't go on to win the nomination for the presidency. Mitt Romney won it a couple times, and obviously he won the nomination, but Steve Forbes dominated the straw poll during the late 90s, and obviously we know how that ended up. But I will say this, it did get a lot of people's attention. It's still getting media coverage. People are referencing it on Sunday talk shows. Well, Rand Paul won at CPAC. There was a huge libertarian, youthful, exuberant energy around the conference, which I was just so energizing to be there. It was one of the greatest 3 days I've had in politics. But what was really exciting, and as I was saying off mic, it's a great time to be a conservative libertarian right now, because you could sit there at CPAC and listen to 15 to 20 speakers. You say, yeah, I'd love to see them run against Hillary. And it's an awful time to be a Democrat because you sit there, yeah, we have Hillary. I mean, we have choices. We have variety. We can poll test. We can really pick and choose, put pressure. And I think it's a really exciting time to be part of that process.
Who was the least impressive person that spoke that day?
Least impressive.
Rashakian response here.
Right. Throughout the 3 days, I was really unimpressed with Sarah Palin. She doesn't get me going. I never liked her. I don't think she's very dynamic.
She could see Russia from her house, and she could not see this invasion coming.
She could see Putin eye to eye. I mean, all this kind of stuff. I was very unimpressed with her. She gets the base fired up. She got, like, a standing ovation. The youth do not – there were just, like, why is she even here? It was more of the older type, really grassroots conservatives. I was not impressed with her. But, I mean, there were a lot of speakers there that really got the crowd going. I think that the grassroots energy is something that has to be tapped into.
At this particular moment, David – the Republican moneyed people who have been trying to convince Jeb Bush to get into the race, they're doing it because they think that Christie's time has come and gone. The national shows today all spent a great deal of time on the Chris Christie Bridgegate scandal. They continue to do it, perpetuating, I think, a false belief that Chris Christie could have actually gotten the Republican nomination,
right,
which I don't think he can,
you're right,
even without Bridgegate. People may disagree with me on that. But again, what does it, to your generation, what does it say if we look to 2016 and the names at the top of the two tickets are Bush and Clinton?
That maybe we're living in a dual monarchy where we had an interruption from Obama. But otherwise, can't we find someone besides these two tired old families to run the country? And after the disastrous presidency of George W. Bush, who wants another Bush standing at the inauguration?
We are going to follow up on that. 1-800-723-80 to an end. I would like to hear someone this evening who thinks it's a good idea and would be very excited about Jeb Bush getting into the Republican field for 2016. Give us a call, 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head to phone calls. Let's go to Plymouth, Indiana. And in Plymouth, Indiana, we have Jack listening to us on WLS tonight. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah, I just think that it should all go back to the way it was, man.
What does that mean?
What does that mean?
Yeah.
We don't need this communist black man up in the office right now.
Well, good thing we don't have one.
Good thing we don't have one.
Guess what? Your wish has been granted. We went right back to where it is. We don't have a communist.
Let's
in the
go
White
to
House.
Jay listening to us in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin on WLS. Go ahead, Jay. You're on the air. Go ahead, Jay. Are you there?
Hey, I appreciate you cutting to the quick, but about Jeb and Hillary, it disgusts me. And, yeah, we are kind of a monarchy. By the way, and don't snicker, just acknowledge it, Barack Obama is a distant cousin to Jeb and George Bush, about 11th, 5th to Dick Cheney. So we are technically kind of a monarchy. Did you? I want a response from you, gentlemen. Did you guys see the article recently that Jeb and Hillary were at an education conference together?
Yes.
And during that time...
There were pictures taken of the two of them.
Exactly. She said the words, "I let my husband go on play dates up to Kenny Bunkport," meaning that he hangs out with the Bushes. Can I get a response to that? Because I think it's disgusting. We are a country of Republicrats and Demopublicans. We need a third or fourth party. Wake up, America.
Who do you want in that field?
Well, I like Rand Paul, but I don't think he's suicidal. By the way, the people that don't like Rand Paul, they will never let him near 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He can maybe become second place in the Republican primary. He'll write books, and he'll be a U.S. senator, and he'll be our ideologue, but... I mean, it's a very we're a very sad state of affairs. On the other side, Democrats.
Who are they? But I want to define, because I'm going to ask everybody to define this. Who are they?
Well, you know, Bruce, you've had a lot of people call, and you guys will just snicker and mock, even though there are super rich bankers, and they're very connected to both media and business. You know all that, and they have a bunch of different names, whether it's, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations or Business Roundtable, Aspen Institute.
Okay.
They meet at hotels called Bilderberg. I mean, we can go on here all day. All right,
let's focus.
Laugh,
wait, I'm not going to laugh at that, but I do want to follow through on that.
Because I
have referred to them as the establishment Republican. These are the people, not just Republicans. I mean, the main thing is they want power. They want to control power, and they look at the White House and the candidates that run for the office of people that are going to protect their status quo. And I agree with you that they can be in the Republican Party and they can be in the Democratic Party. Many of those people were also financial supporters of Bill Clinton, and they probably would be supporters of Hillary Clinton. And let's be honest, these are people that give to both sides, generally speaking, because they want to be close to power, because it's important to them to control their particular political goals. So they become they in my definition. And aren't these the people that I said before the break? These are the people that, and I agree with our caller, there's no way they would be comfortable with Rand Paul being the Republican nominee. I want to get David's response to that.
Well, there is an establishment in both parties, as you point out. And we've seen in recent history, the Republican Party establishment was the greatest enemy to John McCain in the year 2000. The Democratic Party establishment, including the Clintons, was the greatest enemy to Howard Dean in 2004. Dean, who was in many ways an excellent candidate and certainly much better than John Kerry, who was about as riveting as oatmeal. But in terms of Rand Paul and perhaps an establishment opposition to him, I think you'll definitely see that. I'm suspicious of Rand Paul for many reasons, but probably not the
reason.
I think that he's beginning to emit the odor of a fraud.
In what way?
And some people should start smelling it from across the room. Well, he organized the filibuster of Obama's vicious drone strike program,
mm-hmm.
and I applauded him for doing that. And he's been talking a long time about having America take a less interventionist and militaristic foreign policy and posture. Yet just last week, he accused President Obama of weakness on national defense, and he said that we should increase our Pentagon budget,
right?
Which, when it already is greater than the next 15 countries combined. Also,
that's the sound of a man moving towards the center.
No, it's
the sound of a man trying to get GOP donors ready for 2016.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Also, he says that he opposes the Republican Party's social conservatism, yet we know he's a Christian fundamentalist with a long record of supporting the country's most uncompromising and extreme anti-abortion organizations.
He always has been pro-life, and he's a doctor. His father and him are both unapologetically pro-life.
But you want to address any of these other issues?
I mean, I think that if you look at the budgets he's proposed, specifically the budget in 2011, I mean, he cut the defense budget by like 15%, and he proposed to get rid of the Department of the Interior, Department of Energy.
Isn't the first battle in this race for the Republican nomination in this field? Isn't it deciding who gets this, whether it's the inter-party battle between Cruz and Rand Paul.
Right.
That's
so
the first battle.
That's the first one, because if they both run, the grassroots will just kill each other and the establishment will get everywhere they want. There is a faction of grassroots support that is in South Carolina, Iowa, and New Hampshire that if you can capture that kind of magic, you can carry it on to the nomination.
Do you believe that Rick Santorum is going to enter this race?
I hope not. He's a joke.
He may be a joke, but again, I'm just saying there's
the
religious, right? And if it isn't him, is it going to be Mike Huckabee?
Somebody could be.
And that's the other primary. You got to have those two forces. I mean, it's almost like a tournament. It's almost like a Final Four and the Final Two.
Yeah, right.
On that note, we are going to say farewell to Charlie Kirk only for this first hour. If you're listening to us on radio, that's the only way you're getting this show tonight. you will hear him in the second hour. And also joining us this evening is Chris Veronis, and the ever-popular Dan Johnson also joins us. I almost said your old name. And also with us this evening making his maiden voyage is David Masiotra. 1-800-723-8289. We'll be back with another full hour taking your calls when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Dan Johnson, Charlie Kirk, Chris Veronis, and David Masiotra. Our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289 as we come to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. 1-800-723-8289 if you want to email us a comment. btb@museum.tv. And if you want to also join us on the web, beyondthebeltway.com. And also if you want to tweet us a question, you can go to @btbdumont. In the last segment, I summarily dismissed Chris Christie as a potential Republican candidate, or at least nominee of the party. And a couple of people who are around the table sort of disagreed with that. And I want to give them an opportunity why, and maybe there's more than two, but two identified themselves, that they do not believe that Chris Christie is dead political meat. Charlie Kirk, we go to you first.
No, I don't think he's dead at all. He has a couple big advantages. I'll use a different word than I did previously. Some of the advantages that he has. Right now, he has access to the greatest national fundraising base for conservatives, and that is the RGA, the Republican Governors Association. So essentially what he does when he's not governor of New Jersey is he travels the country and meets with the top GOP donors, the top business executives who believe in pro-business conservative principles. So he is compiling a list of 3,000 to 7,000 of the biggest GOP donors that when he runs in a year and a half, he can call and get a war chest ready to go for himself. He's also building a ground game in those states by making friends with governors saying, hey, John Kasich in Ohio, I'll get you elected. I'll raise you the money. But when I call in a year and a half, you better come with an endorsement. Hey, Rick Snyder in Michigan, when I call, you better come with an endorsement. Never underestimate the power of the RGA. It's extremely important. It's a mechanism that on the Republican side, it's a little bit more important than the Democrat side. It's something that could really, really be underestimated.
Romney used that same strategy.
That's correct. Romney used the same thing. It's where he built his war chest. It's when he called Nikki Haley in South Carolina. He said, hey, I need an endorsement right now. She came out and did it. It's a favor. It's a patronage. It's also a fundraising base. And people really don't identify the importance of it.
Interesting. David, you also disagreed that Christie is gone with the wind.
Chris Christie has the best personality skills of all of the candidates. He's very charismatic. He has a compelling public persona. And the cosmetics and the charm factor is very important in American politics. Perhaps we're sitting around, the five of us, having an intellectual conversation on these issues, so there's always the temptation to minimize that. But President,
we've never been accused of that on this in 30 years. We've never been accused of that, but that's okay.
Beyond the Beltway is no salon.
President Obama, very charismatic and charming. If he wasn't, I doubt he would have become president and emerged so quickly. President George Bush had a very captivating persona to some, not so much to me. President Clinton, extremely charismatic.
Right.
So on that issue alone, I think any forecast that pronounces Christie's doom is inaccurate and premature.
Is that why the national media is so enamored with him? Because he is a great phrase maker. And in my view, they would like to be able to cheer him to get into the race, although they now have this scandal, which, again, by the way, there was an internal investigation which he called for. It is an independent firm that looked at it, but they have some connections to Christie. And last week they came out and said This is Randy Mastro came out and basically said, after interviewing 70 witnesses and looking at 200,000 documents, there's no evidence that Chris Christie knew about the bridge closing in advance, although about five or six of the key people were not interviewed by this committee. They've not been interviewed by the New Jersey Democratic Commission that's looking into it, including Ms. Kelly, who seems to be at the focal point, and she has said she's only going to talk to the U.S. attorney, and she described the report last week as being sexist and venomous.
She also said that she will talk to no one unless she gets immunity. But I want to add something to David's point. There is a real style and charisma to Christie. You could argue that the map works against him being in New Jersey, but then again, you know, you also had that with McCain, you know, being in the Senate. You had that with Mitt Romney being from Massachusetts, of all places. There's one more important thing about Christie that you, you know, for the charisma, also he's got a core. And, you know, this actually is a vacuum in the Republican Party right now. And arguably, you can elevate it into a philosophical level, since after the collapse of communism, conservatism has been in a wilderness. It's been in search of an identity. And so what I'm saying Christie brings to the table is a promise to take on special interests, reduce the size of government, reduce spending, and actually follow through with it. And I'm saying there's a huge market there in the primaries and with the Republican electorate for a guy who could deliver on limited government, especially when our last Republican president, George Bush, radically increased the size of government.
Dan, is the reason why the national news media will not let go of this story is that in their heart they know that Chris Christie is more likely to be able to swing Democratic or independent voters to him, and he represents the single greatest threat to President Hillary Clinton, and that's why the Democrats of New Jersey and the national news media are going after him big time, because they know he's the hottest property in the Republican stable.
I don't think so, because, and I may be wrong, isn't he pro-choice?
No, pro-life. He's pro-life with exception of rape and incest.
Okay. Well, that's probably not good enough then to win the nomination, right? Probably not. Probably not good enough to win the nomination, right?
He did not sign a pro-life bill, is what happened.
George Bush had the same exceptions.
But I would say this. I think the reason the national media is taking him on is because they're all based in New York.
Yes,
so
right.
It just happens to be.
He's their local governor. Half of them live in New Jersey.
That's right. So
some of them may have been in the Fort Lee
I think half of them were stuck in that jam, and they're just angry personally.
He described himself with Diane Sawyer this past week as passionate, loving, caring, truth teller. And he went on to say, I think they love me in Iowa.
I think it's pretty obvious what his plans are in a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. No, I think
she asked him, what about Iowa?
Yeah. One,
you know. He didn't.
Oh, no, he didn't volunteer. Well, that was a follow-up question. But again, does he play with this new? And I've said this. I will repeat what I've said in the past. I think the perception of being a politician from New Jersey and all of the perception that represents to a lot of people, primarily in the Bible Belt or in the Midwest, being from New Jersey is not viewed as a positive. No. It's not a clean place to come if that's your history.
There was a Mormon who got the Republican nomination last year. He lost, but he got the Republican nomination.
Well, first,
Mitt Romney can do it. Chris Christie can do it.
First, to Chris's point, Christie has a record of delivering. That's something that distinguishes him from Rand Paul.
Where's the rhetoric?
I think it's time to start giving more serious consideration to people who have a record of achievement in roles of leadership. So that means governors over senators.
Is he your choice? Would you like to see him as one of the choices for president next year? You're coming the closest to an endorsement, although Charlie came pretty close. Is he your guy with everybody that's out there?
Yeah, I like Chris Christie. Norman Mailer...
I wouldn't go that close yet.
Norman Mailer endorsed Hemingway because he said we need someone who looks like a tough guy in the White House. And some of that applies to Christie, too, I think.
Oh.
We
Belmont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. 1-800-723-8289. We talked in the last segment about Chris Christie. I want to just add, button up one more thing, and I guess being someone that's had a weight problem, I can make this comment. Is his weight, Chris Christie's weight, is it a problem when you get to a general election?
One word, gastro bypass.
Yes, but he's still.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks better. He's lost at least 80 pounds.
He looks better. And, you know, to his credit, let's not forget, I mean, the obesity problem in the United States is improving, but one out of every four Americans is considered obese. And
so he'd get the obese vote.
If you lock that down,
you are path to the White House.
But here's this can't be underestimated.
Hillary better start eating cupcakes.
Can't be underestimated because the guy has handled the issue brilliantly. Self-deprecating way and in a way that just draws empathy from people. You know, like he's really handled it like a winner. Like he wants to run and win.
All right, we've talked about the libertarian wing, and we've talked, or basically I've described it as sort of the Ted Cruz Rand Paul battle that goes on, and the Chris Christie battle. He's basically is the establishment candidate, although there's a large number of people that think he is damaged goods, and they're trying to get Jeb Bush into that race, and that would represent the establishment wing. We gave brief coverage to the religious wing. And when I talked about Rick Santorum, no one liked the idea, at least in that segment. And also we have Mike Huckabee, who has at least flirted with the idea. But another name that we have not mentioned at all is Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. Is Marco Rubio yesterday's news?
I think he's the dark horse. I think he's a lot better a candidate than people give him credit for. I think that he does attract a certain element of the Republican Party. I think he's being very smart.
What's the element he attracts?
The element is getting excited about somebody we haven't been excited about in a while. And there's a lot of validity in that, especially amongst grassroots conservatism. Element is Newt Gingrich. I mean, look, South Carolina got behind Newt Gingrich just because he said some pretty inflammatory stuff against John King, and they got excited. But I think that there is an element that they say, you know, we can believe in XYZ. I think he's more charismatic than people give him credit for.
And what Rubio has right now, I think Rubio's best move might be running for re-election. He's a young guy. Getting more experience isn't going to hurt him. And he's also moving into a territory in Republican conservative politics that Ron Paul is trying to get to, but from a different angle, a thoughtful conservative. I mean, he's really speaking to the ideological base of the conservative.
What
Republican
about Governor rank, Walker?
I love Scott Walker. Where
does Scott Walker fit into this mix? Yeah.
I think that if he has 2016 aspirations, he's one of the few people that – and I talk to a lot of people on the right – that if I talk down with a really hard libertarian, they say they don't hate him. And that's a big thing to talk to a libertarian. They say, I would vote for him. I think there is a pragmatic bridge that Scott Walker really resembles. When I was at CPAC, even the hardest libertarian, the Murray Rothbard, von Mises type guy would say – yeah, you know what? He had a lot. I'll vote for him. And correct me if I'm wrong. There is that sentiment.
No, again, you also have the difference in size of resume, that Rubio at this point is a one sheet, and Walker is more of a binder. There's no women in the binder, but you can still you know, get a nomination. You know, Rubio is an attractive candidate. He's a good-looking guy. He's charming. But – again, we've been down
sort of
this,
the establishment. Sort of the establishment guy.
We've been through this before. We elected George Bush as president. He had one term as governor of Texas. Most people in Texas, even Republicans, weren't thrilled with his performance there. Then we elected Barack Obama, who was the least experienced candidate of all time. So let's look at people. Perhaps it's a weird, novel concept.
I think Abraham
Lincoln.
But let's
look at people who've actually accomplished something.
Lincoln had experience.
But he didn't write. He had the exact.
He's a congressman than a senator. Obama's a congressman.
Yeah, he almost had an identical experience in terms of.
Very similar.
Right. Very similar.
Is there anybody else that we're missing? Because Paul Ryan is the other name that. Is Paul Ryan damaged goods at the national level because of his being on the losing side and not being able to carry Wisconsin when he was
similar to some of these other candidates. I think that he's very similar to a Marco Rubio type.
Not charismatic enough?
No, and I also there's only so many niche markets in the GOP. You know, there's the establishment type person, there's the grassroots, and there's the evangelical, and then there's the pragmatic wing that can tie it all together. I don't see where Paul Ryan fits in if there's all these other candidates, and if Scott Walker and Paul Ryan run, that would just be hilarious if two.
And what about Cruz? We talked a lot about. Has Cruz said too much too fast to be viewed as a serious candidate at the moment?
I think he will run, and I think that if he does, it'll be the death of Rand Paul and grassroots conservatism because they'll just cancel each other out. They'll both get 8% in each state, and whoever the establishment wants to run, that's who they'll get.
Which would be a great segue for the need to improve the way we nominate candidates.
And what would you like to see happen?
Well, I'll tell you, Bruce, that the way the Irish do it and the way the Australians do it, and the way they do it for the mayor of every city in the United Kingdom.
They have a drink before they vote?
That's first. You're good and, good and sloshed before you vote. It's the law.
And you have and to then, show your ID.
Right. And then you get to rank the candidates because they insist that you have to earn a majority of the vote. You can't just slip by because the majority splits their vote among two or three similar candidates. You got to earn it with the majority. So you either have a runoff election. Turkey's doing that next week for their presidential election. They've got a runoff. Or they have an instant runoff where you get a first choice and a second choice and a third choice. If somebody gets those majority of the votes of your first choices, well, then you earned it. Congratulations, you won. But if you only can win with 35, 30% of the vote because everybody split their vote, well, let's have an instant runoff. Knock off whoever came in last and see who they would have voted for if your candidate wasn't on the ballot.
Well, California's going with a nonpartisan coming up in June.
They are
that's
coming.
That's going to be interesting.
They have changed it, too.
Are they doing a jungle?
No. Let's go to Mike listening to us in Spokane, Washington. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air. Mike, are you there? Mike, are you there? Speak up. Mike, is anybody there? Is anybody? James at KLBJ, are you there? Who? I hear somebody hissing on the phone. Who is there? Let's try James one more time. James, are you there?
Hello.
Who is this?
This is James in Austin, Texas.
Nice.
That's right, James. You're absolutely right. Now let's go to the next question. What do you have question for us? You want to talk about Chris Christie?
Yeah, the ad nauseum coverage of the Bridgegate thing.
Yes.
And now we have the report that his own lawyer came out and his own group said, well, he didn't do anything wrong. He didn't know anything about it. Okay,
yep.
Well, now the media is clamoring that, oh, my gosh, this can't be right. This can't be possible because it's covered by his own people. Well, what about the coverage of the IRS scandal, the report or the investigation of the IRS scandal being covered or being handled by an Obama donor?
Mm-hmm.
Where can we go with that? Try to explain the comparison for me.
Well, the comparison is that the national news media is not going to do anything that is going to seriously challenge the Obama administration other than to talk about a horrible website, which was pretty hard for them to ignore.
They'll be investigated.
Yeah. Whereas in the case of Chris Christie, as we've said in our couple of segments ago, because he happens to be the governor of the state where a lot of media live, and because I think he's the biggest threat to Hillary Clinton's election, they want to knock off and they want to dust up and they want to dirty up anyone who can beat Hillary Clinton. And again, that's in this particular case, they have this case of what happened in Chris Christie's case, and no matter how much he denies it. People are going to suggest that there's more there. We have to investigate more. You know, we haven't heard enough. I mean, it's the Democrat head of the New Jersey Commission was on a couple of shows today investigating this. And again, they really had no answer to the question. I mean, they would not believe Chris Christie if Jesus Christ himself was a character witness for him. So that's exactly they just want to dirty this guy up.
Don't you?
By the
think
way, I had somebody else. You know, I had somebody else. So yeah. I'm going to tell you something else that a friend told me the other day. They said, "So what if he did that? Isn't that what a politician is supposed to do? Isn't that what Lyndon Johnson would have done?
Well,
you use your power, and what's wrong with that, Dan?"
Well, it's an appalling abuse of government resources for a partisan, petty political agenda, and it seems
and it's never
entirely
been done before.
Well, it has, but you know what? That's part.
It's never
of
been done by a Democrat.
It's never been reported by the media.
People don't like it. Some people do. The hacks, they like it, but swing voters, they're appalled and repulsed by it. And I think the reason why it sticks with Christie is because it's entirely consistent with his personality.
No, it's, yes,
and it
well.
Seems so much more believable to think, like, of course that guy would do it, yeah. than to believe, like, what are you talking about? Chris Christie would bully into submission and would do something.
They would do it because he's fat. That's part of it. He looks like a guy who would do it.
He is a bully.
He talks
That's
like
the
a,
difference. He
like
is, in fact, a bully.
But, I mean, I will say this.
That's
I mean,
true, right? Everybody agrees with that. I mean, he is a bully.
No. He said he's not a bully.
Well, but he is.
I'm not saying that he's – no, I would not agree that he's a bully. First of all, I don't know the man. I don't believe he's a bully. We certainly know people who are bullies.
We don't –
know people. Yeah. We know political leaders in this city who are bullies.
Yeah.
Yes.
Chicago knows bullies.
And,
Chris Christie
– is a bully. You could see the way that he bullies people. He yells at them. He's disdainful. He's contemptuous. And this is entirely consistent.
He doesn't take crap from them. That's what people like about it.
Whether
it's a reporter who has a
dumb question.
Dumb question.
Or a public teacher happens to be a citizen of his state. He yells at people.
What's happening right now is this is the best chance to decapitate Chris Christie right now. This whole Bridgegate thing investigation.
And that's what it's all about.
And that's what it's about.
That's right.
But then why won't his chief of staff talk?
We have summarized.
I want Lois Lerner talk.
Boom.
Back shortly from Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Around the table this evening, we have Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA. We also have, making his first appearance on this program, we have David Masiotra. He is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star, contributed to the Daily Beast, and author of All That We Learned About Living, a new book that will be coming out, and the sub is The Art and Legacy of John Mellencamp. Formerly John Cougar Mellencamp. Also joining us this evening, the president and founder of Aesop Communications, that's Chris Veronis, and a lawyer and a progressive lobbyist with his own firm, and that is Dan Johnson. And we now go back to calls. We go to Dean, listening to us in Chicago on WLS. He's got a choice for president, or at least the Republican nomination. Go ahead, Dean.
Good evening, Bruce. I think as far as Republican governors go, Scott Walker towers above every other Republican governor that might be considered. He has not only handled the public sector union issue in Wisconsin deftly, but more significantly, he has completely turned around the budget issue in Wisconsin from hundreds of billions of dollars in debt to, I think I heard that he's going to be returning almost $1 billion in tax cuts over the course of his 3 years in office, which is absolutely amazing considering that Wisconsin has always been considered quite a progressive state. Chris Christie has nothing even remotely like that. New Jersey is a horrible place to do business. It's one of the highest tax states. People are running out of New Jersey. It's losing population. This is, and even Chris Christie didn't even join the Republican lawsuits by the individual states against Obamacare. He refused to do it, even though.
He walked the beaches in the wake of Sandy with the President of the United States, and I think there are dyed-in-the-wool Republicans. I mean, people that are card-carrying Republicans that will not forget that. So let me ask David, how does Scott Walker propel himself a little bit higher in the ranking, because I think this caller is correct in some of his assessments that Scott Walker should be polling perhaps a little bit better than he is.
At the risk of repeating myself, I think it comes down to power of personality. Walker doesn't have the charisma and charm and media power that Christie has. And I think it comes right down to that. One of the points I was trying to make earlier, but I talk too much, as I often do, and ran out of time.
Never not on a talk show. You can't talk too much. Right. You've got 2 hours to fill.
Be careful
every
saying
Sunday
that. say that at your own risk. But is that also presidents are very important culturally in that the character of the country tends to emulate the character of the president. And Christie would serve a good purpose in that respect, in that I've seen the country's culture gone softer and increasingly sensitive and politically correct and pre-managed and scripted. And Christie battles all of that rather ferociously. So that, as an aside to politics, makes him very appealing.
So we would see an entirely different response to Vladimir Putin if it was President Chris Christie.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Listen, and what do you think that would be, Charlie?
At least in rhetoric. I mean, he would do something melodramatic.
Something blustery.
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I think that Putin would think twice about doing what he was doing if it was President Christie, just because of personality.
Who knows? But at the end of the day, as soon as troops went into Crimea, sanctions should have been levied the next hour.
Yeah.
Instead, they took a week.
So in other words,
there was a bizarre delay.
Yeah, like incredible. And the G8 thing, too. I mean, all while he sews up Crimea. But that's not the point. The point is, who's we're handicapping here. Scott Walker's probably got a bigger problem than what we're talking about. I don't know if he wants it.
Yeah. In other words, he's walking to the presidency, not running for the presidency.
This is a nice segue.
He's got to change his last name.
Yeah. Right. I mean, this is the other thing. 2014 is extremely. This is an extremely important year for midterms and for the pace of Obama's presidency. Scott Walker's got a real hot race. I mean, Burke is not a candidate that should be treated lightly. She's well liked. She's well financed. And she's charismatic, and he's a great governor, but we'll see if he can even win re-election.
Let's go to Ann listening to us in Chicago, actually Algonquin, Illinois. Beautiful Algonquin. It's wonderful this time of year, listening to us on WLS. Ann, are you there? Well, I guess something has happened in Algonquin. Let's go to Brent. How are things in Northbrook? Brent, are you there? We're having problems with our phones this evening. Is anybody there? Any human being on the phone, speak.
I'm here.
And you are?
I am Brent from Northbrook.
That's right. I've heard about you. Go ahead.
So I have a question for Charlie. I'm wondering, how do you convey the attributes, the benefits of capitalism and deliver that message on a college campus when, in general, the environment on a college campus, especially from tenured professors, tends to be one that's more social democratic and fairly hostile towards capitalism and the foundations of it?
What a great question.
That's a great question. So it actually segues nicely to a booklet we're coming up with, which is called The Capitalist Cure. So when we traditionally go to campuses, we would kind of get the cold shoulder to the free market message because we weren't framing it in the kind of social justice egalitarian way. And there is a way to frame it that way, that free markets has raised standard of living substantially throughout the world, and that free trade and individual interest is actually the greatest way to abolish poverty. So, going to Bono's quote, and Bono said this a couple months ago, he said, and it was at like a global summit foundation, he said, foreign aid and government handouts are a sedative, capitalism is the cure. And that's exactly right. Go from an egalitarian type perspective. And, global poverty has been abolished to like 98% thanks to free markets, and it's a great way to go about it.
What about that? Do you agree with the foreign policy of Bono, David?
Oh,
the president.
I like his foreign policy more than I like his music. But speaking of Bono, speaking of John Mellencamp, and earlier I said I believe in rock and roll more than any political platform, with tongue a little in cheek, but that's another way to make the argument to young people, is that cultural vitality and variety is the result of a robust free market. Jazz, rock and roll, hip-hop, Hollywood, blue jeans, all of these things were opposed by moralists in politics and churches. It was the businessman who said, why fight this if I can make money off of it, and put them into the mainstream? So if you like any of this stuff, if you like the fun of America, and America is such a fun place, then you have to support a robust, lively free market, because that's the system of economics and organization of a society produce the most variety.
Does variety, yes, but does the thirst and the challenge and the thirst, I would say, the appetite for the almighty dollar, although it may help the bottom line of a company, and it may help the bottom line of a country, does it necessarily mean that it is good for the lifestyle and the sensibilities of that country? In other words, there's a marketer out there who thinks it's a great idea to engage young, primarily African American, but not exclusively young people, young males, to wear their jeans or their Levi's halfway down their butt crack. They think that's a good idea, and they start a trend to do that. I dare say that in 5 or 10 years, those people that are dressing like that today are not likely to have a meaningful job.
No, you articulated that very well, and I agree with what you're saying. There needs to be a balancing influence. As a Supreme Court justice once said, if you put pornography against Shakespeare on television, pornography would get a higher rating every time.
Well, we know that.
That doesn't mean that we should do it. However,
because it has a happy ending.
Right. Very good.
Only about a third of the Shakespeare's plays do that.
It wasn't a tragedy.
Those censors were.
However, there's also, I mean, a young African American person can also go to the bookstore and buy a Toni Morrison novel. That's a competing product. Now, obviously, more people are buying the Jay-Z records and the jeans below the waist. And that's a problem. But I think that's a problem that results from the decline of communal influences in America and not related to economics.
But the communal influences are coming from others in that community, where the rap stars and the music stars are dressing a particular way. They are promoting a thug-like culture, because that thug-like culture is making some people wealthy. It's making the people who make the records wealthy. It's making the people that make the jeans wealthy. And that isn't necessarily in the long-term best interest of the customers of that product and the way they dress.
I think David's onto something really, really big.
Well, we're an hour and 45 minutes into this. It's about time.
When you talk about engaging a disaffected segment of the electorate, getting them energized, products certainly are part of the marketplace, but so are the people, the actors, the risk takers. So 50 Cent may wear Levi's, I don't know, but 50 Cent is 50 Cent because of what he did. He took risks, and that is what we admire. And I think that's what David's getting at.
What risk did he take?
I think he dropped out of school or something to just go rap.
Okay.
Well, he took risk, and he was...
Well, then there's a lot of risk takers.
Well, I'm saying that is the story here, and that's the message, and that's what we need more of.
Go ahead.
Let's let the president...
20 seconds.
I'm not
seconds.
A fan of hip-hop for many reasons, but millions of people consume those records. Millions of people don't emulate the lifestyle. I think it starts with the household and the community surrounding that shapes values, not the music.
Eric Cantor listens to Jay-Z, and we can see how that ends up. So,
We'll see if he walks into the house someday with his jeans halfway down the butt crack. We'll see if he's picked up.
It'd be a dress code violation.
A dress code violation. He would no longer be the majority leader of the U.S. House. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back. Let's head west to Spokane, Washington. Mike is listening to us on KXLY. Go ahead, Mike. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. Can you hear me now?
I can. You sound great.
Yeah, I apologize. We had phone difficulties there.
That's okay.
But how about Governor Chris Christie as a vice presidential candidate, if it comes down to that? He's from New Jersey, the Northeast, New York, strong population center, strong electoral college. He's pro-life, which I like. And
I don't believe that Chris Christie has the personality to be a number two. I don't think he would take it. He would also overshadow whoever number one is.
He'd be a Teddy Roosevelt number two.
That could be. It's a good thought. Let's go on. I'm not getting a signal. If we have another caller, let's go to them right now. Punch a line and let's see who it is. Go ahead. Are you on the air? Anybody
Hello?
There? Yes, go ahead. Is this Ann?
Yes, I called about...
Ann, I recognized your voice. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I think actually the number one problem the Republicans are going to have, and it's certainly a dilemma for me, they have so many top-notch, sterling possible candidates for the presidency. I mean, in contrast to, I mean, you look at the leadership, people in leadership positions in the Democrat Party. I see we've got Harry Reid, we've got Dick Durbin, there, of course, is Hillary. There's just no one there that could provide the bold kind of leadership that the country needs today. I mean, they're bold, any of those people in the Democrat Party, but they just do not compare with the kinds of ideas, with the just a totally different type of personality.
You sound like a very enthusiastic Republican, and I'm going to.
Well, I am enthusiastic.
I know. Well,
I'm hopeful.
I'm going to take your question. I'm going to expand upon it a little bit, and I want Dan to talk about something that we talked about several weeks ago in this program when we were doing the show from Los Angeles, and that is because the media does play an important role in our presidential elections, and because of all this activity and all of the personalities and all of these interlocking wars within wars that will be part of this Republican primary process as to who knocks off who and the multiple candidate field, which we're going to have without question, it's going to suck up and it's going to take a lot of the media focus. And if the Democratic Party is a coronation of Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. it is going to rob the Democratic Party of presenting some new ideas and having some debate and showing some vitality to new voters who've never voted before, libertarians, younger voters. And it's going to be that coronation, which may save her a lot of money in a primary. It may turn out to be not very good for the party. It gets back to sort of the first question I asked tonight,
yeah.
and that is, if you've got Hillary Clinton or if it's Joe Biden, you have candidates that are perceived as yesterday's candidates, and you look at number three, whether it's Governor Schweitzer or you look at Martin O'Malley. I mean, those are the number three and number fours that are being at least mentioned, and I'm not so sure they generate the type of media exposure compared to, you know, five or six, or we rattled off seven names on the Republican side that are controversial, if not electable.
You know, if part of me would like primaries are a lot more. I mean, to the earlier point, you know, we're likely if Hillary runs, it'll be a very boring primary season, and it's exciting to be engaged in a real open contest. So Republicans.
Boring is never good.
It's not very good. And so I agree that a coronation is, on the one hand, not great for ginning it up. On the other hand, the Illinois gubernatorial race is kind of an interesting mm-hmm. potential preview of maybe the 16, because somehow we figured out in the Democratic primary, largely because Bill Daley decided not to run at the last minute, We didn't have any contested primaries at all on the Democratic side. And our governor, who is not polling well, Pat Quinn, was not challenged. And on the Republican side, there was a huge battle. There were four candidates. It was a fiercely fought to the very end. And they spent a ton of money, and we didn't have to spend a dime, which was great.
That was kind of a protest vote, though, in the Democratic primary. I mean,
well, there was some.
Teo Hardeman got 30%.
So the question will be whether this sort of no contest on the Democratic side, a fierce contest on the Republican side, which very well could happen on the presidential side, mm-hmm. no contest for Hillary, huge contest on the Republican, does that help or hurt?
There's something else that's happening in Illinois, and I said this the other day at a gathering, and that is that when you look at what's happening in Illinois, and for those around the country, the winner of the Democratic primary unopposed has been Pat Quinn, who was the former lieutenant governor, took over for Blagojevich, got his own on his own year, 4-year term, and now is going for a second one. You have on the Republican side Bruce Rauner, who is an outsider, has not run for office, a self-made multimillionaire, very successful billionaire. Well, put a lot of money into his campaign and beat three former members of the state Senate, including the state treasurer, which are fills out the thing. So you have, and what has already been suggested is there's been so much made of the richness of the Republican candidate and the way that he spent his money and basically came from nowhere. I think the race for governor in Illinois is a harbinger of what the race for president is going to be in 2016. I believe the Democrats, primarily, and again, they've introduced a millionaire's tax, the Speaker of the House, Madigan. I think what's happening in Illinois in 2010, they're going to test market the concept of class warfare as a way to get elected. The Democrats have tiptoed around it in the last several elections. If it works in Illinois, and I think it's going to be, you have stylistic changes,
great
but this
point.
Is about populism. This is about the rich against the poor. It's going to be played big time. Both sides are going to pour tons of money into the Illinois gubernatorial race because it's a test market. Illinois will be a test market for the campaign themes of 2016.
You're right.
That's what I say. We'll talk about it on our next broadcast. I've laid out the theme. Tune in next week. Charlie, thanks very much for being with us. Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA. David, thank you very much on your maiden voyage, and also Chris Veronis and Dan Johnson for being with us. This program is a Gen B production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Todd Nebel and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.